Hello, I'm Adrian Daub.
And I'm Moira Donegan.
Whether we like it or not, we're in bed with the right.
So, Adrian, today we are going to be talking about a genre of fiction that is captivating women readers, inspiring passionate fan communities online, and quietly keeping the entire publishing industry afloat. That's right. Today we are talking about romantasy.
That's right. Not books about 1933. Romantasy is what's keeping the book industry afloat.
No, I think this genre, it's a combination, as the portmanteau implies, between romance fiction and sort of fantasy genre fiction. And it really took off during the pandemic and is now this like commanding force in our cultural life. And I think the easiest thing in the world to say about these books is that they're wish fulfillment fantasies, right? They're transporting, they're sexy, they involve these like women heroines who are stand-in for the readers, who are beloved and capable in some ways, and also sort of like rescued in others, right? So it's very easy to say like, yeah, people read these because it represents something that they desire. But I think what's a little more compelling a question and a little bit more up in bed with the rights alley is a question of like, what kinds of wishes are the romantasy books fulfilling? Where do these desires come from? And what does a fantasy about their fulfillment in fiction achieve for the readers? And to answer that question, I think we kind of need to call in the big guns. So we're thrilled today to welcome Abby Kluchin of Ordinary Unhappiness, friend of the show and absolute genius. Abby, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me. I will strive to live up to that incredible introduction.
So for those of you who don't know, we're going to link to Abby's podcast in the show notes, but Abby is the host of Ordinary Unhappiness, which is a podcast about psychoanalysis, culture, and the ways we suffer now is, I think, your tagline. And I always love hearing you say the ways we suffer now. It's like, it's a very comforting thing to hear. And Abby is also just like somebody who does a lot of really generous public-facing scholarship. She's one of the co-founders of the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research, where I love to take classes. It's a really kind of great thing that happens. And she's really good at taking these cultural phenomena and sort of explicating their like broader implications in a way that's very rigorous, but also very clear. And she actually came to us and was like, hey, do you guys want to talk about romantasy?
Yeah. And so we should probably mention a couple of titles here. When you first mentioned this, Abby, and when you first mentioned it, Moira, I was like, I've heard this term, but I've actually nothing to attach it to. But it turned out I had one of these books already in my library. Someone had recommended A Court of Thorns and Roses to me, which is the first volume in a 5-book series by Sarah J. Maas. But the other ones are the Fourth Wing series by Rebecca Yarros. That's the other sort of classic of the genre. And I have to, so just to sort of explain to listeners in case they're super fans of this genre, like where I'm coming from, I am now 3/4 through the first volume of Court of Thorns and Roses. And I'm digging it. I got to be honest. I'm kind of digging it. I'm not sure I can like analyze every part of it yet, but like, it took a little bit for me to get into. We can talk about why that is. It has something to do with pacing, but I think there's something interesting going on with the pacing. And by now, I am kind of hooked. That's where I'm at. Moira, how far did you make it into this?
I read the full first A Court of Thorns and Roses. And Abby had come to us with this idea for this podcast, and I had been really excited about it because I knew these were really, really popular books. And I sort of wanted to do what she told me to do, which is just like kind of like, let it happen to you, right? Just like, don't resist these books. Allow their power to like sort of carry you away. And that is really like what they do. They are kind of hypnotic. I had an initial like resistance reaction. Like my experience of the first 100 pages or so of the Sarah J. Maas A Court of Thorns and Roses was like, wow, it's crazy how much I am too good for this. And then I sort of thought, okay, that's a limited critical response. It's like a very easy one. I can't like make a critical case for these books as like great works of literature. But I think it's more interesting to look at them from the point of view of somebody who's like really getting something out of them, who's experiencing a lot of pleasure, a lot of excitement, a lot of like you know, gratification. And what I will say about these books is that they are incredibly transporting. You kind of can't put them down. They are immersive. They put you in this different world. And I felt sort of like I was embodying that world, even when it didn't always make sense, even when it wasn't, say, particularly imaginative, right? Because something that's very interesting about these books also, and that is characteristic of the romanticy genre in general, it is very, very bounded by trope and by formula. And something that is really compelling about these is that they're very transporting, they're very absorbing, they really kind of take you out of your life and put you into this other world with this escapist fantasy, but also you're never exactly surprised by what's going on. So maybe before we say too much, we should go to Abby. And Abby, tell us how you discovered this genre and what it was like for you to first read them.
Well, first, let me say, Moira, I'm so glad that you let yourself have that sort of experience. I realized after I'd sent you that email that what I should have said was like, you're going to hate the romance, so just like lean into the fantasy of it all. And it sounds like that's exactly what you did. Thank you for giving me an introduction that makes me sound like a serious person so that like now when I confess myself to be a basic bitch who likes to read fantasy novels, you know, I also have some sort of like modicum of dignity. But I think like so many people, I started reading these during the pandemic. I was home. I was teaching on Zoom. Adrian, you know what that was like.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, I certainly needed to escape the realities of my existence a little bit more. And I also grew up reading fantasy. And I grew up reading feminist fantasy, which is like a real thing and which is not what I would call romanticy. I would call those two pretty distinct kinds of things.
Yeah.
But I've definitely found myself in a position of needing to escape. And a series with several or like more than several 600, 700 page books where, just like you say, Moira, you're in this kind of pleasantly hypnotic state, but also there's the comfort of like, you basically know what's going to happen because the genre conventions are so strong that you can intuit them even if you've never read one before. That scratched an itch for me. So I read the Sarah J. Maas books, or at least I read A Court of Thorns and Roses and the books that came after. It's not done yet. Book 6 is coming out.
Oh, shit.
The main story is wrapped up. Sorry, Adrian, can I spoil this for you?
Sure. I have a suspicion of I know where it's going. Yeah.
Okay. I don't usually say the word Freudian in like a derogatory mode, but I will now. It's like it's wrapped up Freudianly where the protagonist like gets her man and gets her baby and it's a boy. And so like,
oh, wow.
By that, you know that that story is essentially wrapped. But so she's still like taking the other side characters off into other places.
So that actually, I mean, we're going to talk about different antecedents, but one kind of book I thought about, like there is like feminist fantasy. Like I'm thinking of someone like Marion Zimmer Bradley, right? Like The Mists of Avalon was kind of a big seller in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah. Although, side note, Adrian, do you know about the Marion Zimmer Bradley?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
No, cool. I know.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure.
But it was billed at the time.
Yeah, like, no, yeah, I loved that
bad,
as a child.
Bad person.
Sorry, what happened? I don't know.
She protected her pedophile husband, basically, right?
Oh, Jesus.
Well, then after she died, her daughter accused her.
Oh, shit, that's right.
Of sexual assault. I mean, it's a very dark, dark story. And
yeah,
she's
really
the
dark
one who wrote. Yeah, she's sort of like the mother of feminist fantasy in some ways. She wrote this epic retelling of the Arthurian legend from the women's perspectives. And then I guess it was about 10 years ago this came out.
Jeez.
And,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah, that's bad. But the other person I thought of was someone who writes sort of at the intersection between historical fantasy and romance and who has a huge readership, but a very gendered readership, was Diana Gabaldon, or is that how you say her name? The Outlander series?
Oh, yeah.
I never read those.
I've read like parts of it, again, on someone's recommendation. Those books were too long for me, I got to confess. Each of them feels about as long as The Winds of Winter will be if it ever appears. But it's interesting because it has all this time travel and like all these surprising kind of political things happening. But the backbone of it is a very standard kind of romance plot. And the reason I'm bringing it up is because it's this interesting thing where the romance plot kind of grounds you and you is predictable. And it allows the author to kind of weave a lot of stuff around that's unpredictable.
Yeah.
But like the romance part is sort of its spine. If I'm wrong about this, listeners can correct me, but my impression always was that like the genius of Outlander was that like its formula combined with something that's spun around that goes a little bit against formula.
And it strikes me that the big commercial antecedent for these is Twilight, right? Like this.
Oh, absolutely.
Massive multi-book series with a spin-off movie franchise that is focused around a fantasy, a magical element sort of grafted on to a romance novel plot. But, you know, this kind of material, the like sexual allure of a non-human male figure, is also something that's been explored by like what we might consider more traditionally artistically ambitious, like literary fiction writers. Like I'm thinking of Bear by Marion Engel, which is a 1976 novel about a woman who is tasked with taking care of a bear, like a literal bear, and finds herself having sexual urges and eventually a sexual relationship with the bear. There's also this like famous novel, Mrs. Caliban, which is like a cult classic by Rachel Ingalls from 1982, which is about a woman's relationship with a creature that has escaped from like a science experimental biology lab down her street. And these are like works coming from the tail end of the second wave that are, you know, looking at women's sexuality and its monstrousness and its relationship to violence, right? In this way that is deliberately about breaking taboos. But I think this advent of romanticy, this like specific genre that we're talking about today, really is something new, right? And it emerged during the pandemic, like Abby was saying, as this kind of like escapist mode from the terror and claustrophobia of those eras, but also as something that could be really participatory. I think it's really difficult to talk about romanticy without talking about TikTok.
Yes, or book talk specifically.
Yes. Yeah. Do you like want to tell us about this world?
I mean, I will say that I did, upon receiving your request to like situate listeners in the world of romanticism and when did it start or one of the main texts and this and that and the other thing. I have like book talk in my notes, but I can't with TikTok. I mean, I've seen a couple, but it's just like, I feel like someone has hit me on the head with a hammer every time I watch like extremely short form video. But I think like the existence of it is really, really important because, and I think we'll get to this more when we start to talk about the ways in which romanticism allows women specifically to identify with this main character who is generally traumatized and ends up overcoming trauma and becoming stronger and becoming a fighter and this and that. But it is a social phenomenon and it is a social media phenomenon. There are fan communities. You know, it's not just book talk, but it's also like Goodreads. And I think I would almost compare the fan communities to something like the Swifties. No disrespect to Taylor Swift. I like Taylor Swift just fine. But like if you've heard one Taylor Swift song, you've heard every Taylor Swift song to a certain extent. And if you've read one of these, you know, you've read all of these, again, to a certain extent. But that means that people take up this project of reading them and scrutinizing them in ways that the text just simply won't bear. Like the way that people are looking for Easter eggs in Taylor Swift songs. They're looking for like deep esoteric occult meaning in romanticism novels. Like perhaps like there's numerology that's going on. Again, I don't think it's something that the text necessarily bear, although I do think they are like, they're such important objects for the kind of scrutiny that we're giving them. But there's something that's a little bit perverse about looking at what it is that makes them individual, given that they are written in some way to fulfill the same function over and over and over and over again.
Yeah, it's a little funny to engage in like numerology and analyzing a book that the author claims to have written in like a month and a half.
Right, exactly.
Like, no hate, but like, I'm guessing Sarah J. Maas was busy just typing the words, because like that takes time too. One thing just to support this, and something that I think distinguishes it a little bit from the Twilight phenomenon, whenever that was, like 10, 15 years ago, is that A Court of Thorns and Roses is probably the book I've seen people read in public as a physical book the most over the last year and a half. That's in fact why I bought it. I get fascinated with what people read on the train or on the bus or on the beach or wherever. And like, this book was a mainstay. You'd get sometimes two people together, each with a copy of this book, which I hadn't seen for any book ever, really. And that certainly wasn't true for Twilight, which famously like sort of coincided with the Kindle revolution, where everyone was sort of quietly reading it on their Kindle. Like, this is one where people are like, yeah, I'm reading sex scenes, so what? You know, so like, I was like, oh, this is interesting. And once I started reading it, I was like, okay, wow. So you really were putting the flag down there, ladies. Just like, I'm at the pool reading about fairy sex, you know? The other thing I wanted to bring up, which I didn't know about these kind of hidden meanings that people were looking for, but to me, more so than the Stephanie Meyer books, at least the Maas book that I've now three quarters read, is a consummate remix, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's pastiche is putting it too strongly.
It's a Beauty and the Beast retelling.
Yeah, I mean, for listeners who haven't read these, it's basically about a young woman in the mortal world. She's living kind of a fantasy heroine life. She's a Katniss Everdeen, like she's skinning a wolf by like page 8 or whatever. But there are fairies in this world, High Fae, and the wolf that she is skinning at the beginning of the novel turns out to be one of them. And so she has to follow a very grumpy exemplar of the Fae to his estate in the other world. Now, the reason that's interesting is like, to me, on the one hand, it has all these fantasy tropes, right? Dark forests, fairies, et cetera, et cetera.
Starving family.
Starving family. On the other hand, it's very clearly just a riff on Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, yeah.
It's just very much a fairy tale. And then it's sort of, once you get into the domestic sphere, you end up with all the trappings of the age in which the fairy tales were collected, sort of the late 18th century. Like, it has real Regency costume drama energy. Unlike Game of Thrones, which I feel like has the medievalism all the way through, this series sort of does a temporal break the moment it sort of abandons its more straightforwardly heroic fantasy trappings and is suddenly kind of like, yeah, Jane Austen redux. And so, like, it is a consummate mashup. It's really just kind of using different motifs and tropes and kind of grafting them onto each other in, I think, a pretty smart, interesting way. But it's interesting that, like, people are looking for deep meanings when what it's really doing virtuosically is, like, smashing together surfaces, right?
Yes, absolutely. We're going to use Sarah J. Maas and Rebecca Yarros as our kind of, like, specimen text.
Yeah.
But since Adrian and Moira are either done with or partway through book one, I will kind of pick up here and say that A Court of Thorns and Roses, like book one, is a kind of fake out.
Oh.
So like, spoilers for anyone listening, this book has been out for a long time. I don't feel very bad about that. If this is Beauty and the Beast, you know, you think that she's found her mate, right? This is something that we'll talk more about, the fated mate. But actually, she's going to suffer horribly through a whole series of trials to save his life, only to find out that her mate is somebody else.
Whoa.
Yes. Do you want to know who it is, Moira?
Who? Tell me.
It's Rhysand, or Riz? Rhysand? I've never said that out loud. Who is the High Lord of the Night Court, who turns out to be much more powerful and much hotter, and he truly understands her. And he rescues her from the first fake-out love interest, you know, the Beast and the Beauty and the Beast of it all, who actually turns out to be, like, a domestic abuser.
Interesting.
And he rescues her from that entire situation, and he brings her back to life after the traumas of the first book, and he teaches her to read. She's illiterate.
Oh, yeah, she is, yeah.
Yeah, and then here, I'll sum up the rest of this in, like, two sentences. There's, like, a long, slow burn of, like, will they or won't they? And yes, they will, and she becomes High Lady of the Night Court, and they have a beautiful telepathic relationship that everyone envies, and they become mates. Hijinks ensue. There's a lot of war, thousands of pages of war. And then, as I previously spoiled it,
she has a kid.
She has a kid. There's drama around that, but yeah.
So that's also the difference then to Twilight. I must admit that like I hated those series. I hated those books. I hated those movies. And part of it is because it's essentially all about extending runway and empathy to a domestic abuser, right? Like this guy is like 4,000 years old watching her sleep and she's like, well, I should find it in my heart to love him. It's like, well, I don't think you should, girl. I think you should run the other fucking way.
Well, his sexual desire is also like depicted as a literal impulse to murder, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like somehow she has to make peace with that. It's nice to hear that that's not where this is going. And then in fact, these books are saying like, you don't owe this guy anything.
No.
And just because he's gruff and abusive, he might just be gruff and abusive. He's not hiding a heart of gold. It's just a bunch of red flags. Yeah, which I was picking up on. I was withholding judgment. Also, I was pronouncing it Rysand in my head. I was like, well, he keeps showing up in a way that like, I don't quite know why he's here. It's kind of like Roger Ebert's law of character economy. I'm like, right, if a character's like, and he was there too. And you're like, oh, okay. Like, feels like this, he might still have a role to play. You know, and I'm like, I don't think he's a traitor. So I think he might be the actual guy.
So they needed a man with dark hair as well as a man with blonde hair.
Yeah, it's very like the movies of the 1950s where there's one brunette and one blonde.
Yes.
And they have to like play off of each other. It's like that, but with just men. Like there's like different types of white guy.
And aren't they introduced within like two pages of each other?
Probably. Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah. Do you want me to do the Rebecca Yarros?
Yeah. Tell us about the fourth wing, because this is the one with dragons.
Fucky dragons.
Yeah. Moira, I'm a little bummed that you didn't read Fourth Wing, because I think it might give you some joy.
Now I have to read it, and it will take me like 2 days in which I accomplish nothing else, but just like sit down and read all of these alone in my apartment.
I just think that you're really going to identify with the dragons.
I love this like light ethnic ribbing I'm getting. You're like, before we started recording, Abby was like, well, the dragons are Irish.
And grumpy, like delightfully cantankerous. It's like very on brand for you.
I do feel very seen. Thank you.
But also, they're the only real characters.
Yeah.
You know, as much as I think that these books are a vast improvement over Twilight, where like the main character just kind of like drags around and you can't see me, but I'm making like a Victorian fainting couch kind of gesture. The primary trope of all of these is the like, quote unquote, like strong female protagonist. But that's kind of like an empty set in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It's there so that anyone can insert themselves into it. And there are virtues to that for, you know, at least therapeutic purposes and also just for imaginative purposes, right? Like there are good reasons to write characters like that.
But they're boring.
They're not drawn out.
Like they'd have nothing going on, right?
Yeah.
They're not very nuanced characters. You don't know a ton about their psychic lives. They're not very differentiated from one another or from like other people in general. It's just kind of like concept of woman.
Yeah, concept of woman who can kick your ass.
Yeah.
Which is, again, a vast improvement on concept of woman as fundamentally passive while someone else is the agent of her destiny. Like, a vast upgrade. Okay, but let me give you the TLDR on the Rebecca Yarros books. These are more recent. Fourth Wing came out in 2023, and there are three books out so far of a projected five-book series. To speak a little bit to how these have been just, you know, time when increasingly nobody is reading, everybody is reading these books. She sold 12 million copies in 2 years.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. It was harder to find the statistics on ACOTAR, but I did go and look at Sarah J. Maas's website, which claims that of all of her books, she has sold 70 million copies.
Wow.
70 million. So I think like perhaps it makes sense as we're thinking about the ways in which these characters have very little character that 70 million people can find themselves in there.
Yeah, it's a vehicle for reader identification, and
yes,
that is a very broadly applicable mandate. Yeah.
Yes, but it's a publishing juggernaut. Okay, so here's what happens in Fourth Wing. We follow our hero, Violet Sorengale, who, in a kind of twist of the genre, which, you know, is all about strength, the strong woman, suffers from what seems to be Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which the author does as well. She was very clearly trying to get some representation of folks who are dealing with that into the books. But that is particularly interesting because this book is set at a battle college.
Oh.
And the mother of our heroine is the general. So she's all about strength in a very literal sense. So although Violet is, like, there's much made of how she's physically weak and how she's in constant pain, she is smarter than everybody else. And so she finds a way not only to survive, but actually to thrive in the world of dragon riding, which is honestly, like, somebody dies on almost every page. It's really, you're just like, oh, you're just going to kill off half of the freshman class. Like, maybe like two-thirds of the freshman class. I mean, I can't overstate the extent to which there's just, like, death and dying and school all mashed together.
It's the Dragon Riders of Pern reimagined.
Yes!
As, like, Battle Royale.
Exactly. Exactly.
Off mic, you were saying that Rebecca Yarros, the author of the Fourth Wing series, is in fact married to an Air Force pilot, right? And lives in Colorado near the Air Force Academy, right?
He's in military. I don't know more than that.
Okay. Well, it's easy for me to see, like, a comparison between, like, the flying dangers of war.
Yeah.
You know, just transpose onto dragons instead of, you know, jets or helicopters or whatever the case may be.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, so Violet, here's the quick and dirty version of it. She bonds the single most badass battle dragon that there is, and also, just for a bonus, a kind of, like, baby special dragon. And her dragon is mated to the dragon of the man who should be her mortal enemy, but turns out to be...
What? What?
Her love—I don't want to say lover. Jesus, that sounds awful.
Her intended.
I think when we're talking about the romance and romantasy genres, we have to say lover, and we have to say it like those people on SNL.
Lover,
like, yeah, the creepy people in the hot tub.
Yeah.
Lover.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So, and his name, which I have never said out loud, but it starts with an X, is Zayden Riorson. I want to say.
Wow.
We should say it is typical of the genre to have very, like, vowel-forward names that
it's
sound
true.
Kind of Nordic or Celtic.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, that's totally right. That's totally right. So Violet and Zayden, classic enemies to lovers, despite the fact that they are telepathic, and this is true in ACOTAR too, they have communication problems. Like, I don't know. The fantasy, I think... of being able to read your beloved's mind and vice versa should mean that you aren't constantly, like, the plot other than war is basically, like, Violet and Zayden keep misunderstanding each other. Mm.
It also strikes me as, like, typical of, you ever watch, like, an old movie, even from, like, the 90s, and be like, oh, this whole plot falls apart if anybody has a cell phone?
Has a phone.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like that. It's like, oh, this whole plot falls apart if people can read each other's minds, and therefore we're just going to, like, reinsert this obstacle so that our characters can have dramatic tension.
Yes, absolutely. And if I were going to keep summing this up, it's almost the same as summing up ACOTAR, which is, like, hijinks ensue, so does war. And my favorite part of this, I was thinking about this, Moira, when you were asking via email, like, what's the fantasy? I was like, for me, the fantasy is that even though war is happening, everyone keeps going to class. They're like, look, we have a mission, but after that, we got to get up and go to our 9 a.m. Did you do the homework?
But that'll give readers old enough to have been children in the late 90s, early 2000s, some real Harry Potter flashbacks, right? Where, like,
yes.
Also the body count just keeps rising, and it's like, but you're late.
You're late for potions.
Yeah. For the defense of the dark arts. And you're like, are we going to talk about the kids who just got fucking creamed? Or are we just going to plow right through it?
Yeah.
But it's also about, like, the power of the personal, right?
Yeah.
Like, the sexual relationships, the romantic relationships, the sort of, like, suspense and intensity involved with those retain their power even when stuff is, like, literally on fire around you. The fantasy there, I think, is partly about, like, assigning power to those parts of your life, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in our unfortunate, banal real life, like, that stuff can kind of seem a little less important, or, like, it can recede from the front of your mind at times when you're under stress.
Yeah. One other question that this brings up for me is, and for listeners not familiar with the fantasy genre, this may sound like a strange question because you think like, well, any books about, you know, dragons and wizards are going to be kind of YA-ish. But like the romance genre by and large is not taken to be a YA genre just in terms of marketing, because you don't want to end up on any banned lists because people are just like humping so heavily. You want to be able to sell in Texas and like be in school libraries and all that shit. At the same time, some of the tropes we're comparing this to are straight up YA tropes.
Yeah.
And I have to admit that like my impression was that the readership here is targeted at adults. Do you have a sense, did this come out of a YA space and then sort of escape containment? Or is this adult fiction that sort of just happens to also traffic in tropes that a lot of people grew up reading when they were like in their mid to late teens?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's one that the publishing industry has answered also with a new category of NA.
Right.
Or like new adult, which suggests to me that it's just a new name.
Yeah.
I feel like we're a few years past the conversation about like, is it okay for adults to read kids' books or YA? Because the culture has moved on.
Yeah.
The answer is mostly like, well, if adults are reading at all, they are probably reading something that is functionally YA. I don't know in terms of the demographics of the readership, other than to say that it skews towards women.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I'm interested in as well. I do feel like there are a lot of books as of recent that sort of live in that space, but I do think they're often by women authors and seem to be targeted at women. I'm also thinking here about the work of R.F. Kuang, which like likewise is often set at schools and like has some of the trappings of like, I think she's just kind of enjoys sort of drawing on things that she read when she was the heroine's age, basically, which makes sense to me. But it's interesting because like, of course, in fantasy that is targeted at men, I think we've seen more and more of a divide of like the YA and the adult space, right? Like, I mean, Song of Ice and Fire, which I guess, you know, has readers of all genders, but like very much the idea was like, this isn't The Hobbit. This is adult fantasy, right? I mean, what makes it adult? Just the violence and the gratuitous sex. But still, there is an element there of like, don't give that to your 16-year-old, right? Or I was thinking also of like some like Glenn Cook's The Black Company series, which is extremely, has a very unique, I think, readership profile in the sense that it's extremely popular among the armed forces.
Mm.
Those are new adults. Those are NA in many ways, but they are NAs that we're training to kill other NAs. So like we don't tend to think of them as like needing their own special kind of genre to handhold them into adulthood. So there's also something interesting with age and gender going on here, it seems to me.
It's interesting. When I think about Game of Thrones, I don't think of it as any more grown up than ACOTAR or Fourth Wing.
Well, I'm thinking about how it's marketed and how it's described.
Yeah, no,
right?
I hear you in terms of marketing, but I'm thinking also now, and to be fair, it has been a long time since I have read The Lord of the Rings, but I guess I would take those books more seriously in some sort of sense.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know how much of this is just like the presence of sex and violence.
Yeah.
That's what's at work here in the labeling and the marketing.
Yeah, I guess The other kind of question, and you already alluded to that. I mean, you're coming to us from a psychoanalytic podcast and you already invoked Freud. I guess part of it is the question of analysis, terminal and interminable, right? Mm-hmm. Like you can tell pretty much after the first third of A Court of Thorns and Roses that this is a story that no matter how long the author chooses to make it, has a telos, right? This is the maturation process of a young woman. And she's going to learn some lessons. It's a Bildungsroman. It has to come to an end.
Yes.
Whereas, like, famously, George R. R. Martin, sorry, listeners, you're hearing it here first, is never going to fucking finish that thing because it's interminable. Because, like, these people trip all over themselves to kind of stab each other in the back. It's like Succession. It kind of builds on itself and is so deeply interested in politics that it's always going to find another way to kind of tweak your expectations. There is no fulfillment. Any fulfillment that you think you're getting from Game of Thrones, George R. R. Martin is eventually going to throw in your face, like, you idiots, right? And if that happened in The Court of Thorns and Roses, I think it would actually break the generic compact. It really feels like,
yeah,
this is what these books are going to be about, and you kind of have to pay off on that. And that might be a distinction here we can make between something also like The Lord of the Rings, and something like The Black Company, where like, right, like The Lord of the Rings is all about, will you get the object to the place it has to go? And then like, you know, you basically sail off into the sunset, right? Or like, is this a real world in which like after that, there's another job you have to do and it sucks?
Well, it strikes me that something that the romantasy genre relies on is this like romance trope, right? There has to be an end. And what Abby has described with ACOTAR is like, there's one fake out, right? But how many times can you use that strategy, right? Like I could see Sarah J. Maas sitting down with a calculator going like, if I could give this chick like two more like fake loves of her life that turn out to not be worth it and just like turn her into a little bit of a serial monogamist, I could buy like an island, you know? Like, and I think that has diminishing returns because of the expectations of the readership, right? Yeah. Because the genre makes this promise to its readers, and part of the function of these books and part of what they fulfill for their readers, I think, is that they don't break their promises.
Yeah. Although, I mean, like, again, the Outlander series has been able to wring truly astonishing amounts of pages out of what is ultimately like a love story that I don't think breaks the generic convention. I think it's fairly, the generic compact is intact, but Gabaldon is able to like really wring a ton of mileage out of it. I mean, you know, this would be the Pamela or Clarissa model of like, fucking A, we're only 1,200 pages into this thing and like they're not going to find each other yet.
But, you know, we do have a couple of like themes that seem to recur throughout these books, right? So one is that like there's a protagonist who's a teenage girl or a very young woman who gets transported from sort of like a mundane existence into a new magical environment where she is tasked with more responsibility or has higher stakes, right? Another thing is that there are men who appear to be her enemies or threats to her who become her confidants and lovers.
Oh, and the other thing we might mention is that like at least in A Court of Thorns and Roses, I thought it was interesting that she already has a guy she's sleeping with at the beginning, but he sort of doesn't matter and he sort of shuffles off like on page like 40, which is kind of interesting because like what it communicates, which I very much liked, was that it's not about like sexual initiation. This woman is sexually initiated.
Right.
This is about like she doesn't think there's much to him. She's like not going to end up with this guy. She's, which I also liked, very clear on protection. Apparently they have a way of prevent birth in this fantasy setting. And she's like, oh, you're using it, dude.
Oh, yeah. And it's his responsibility. Like, that's another, like, little wish fulfillment is, like, he's reliable and responsible and taking the initiative on birth control. I was like, wow, that is just a nice little... These are not what I would call concretely feminist books, but there are gestures in that, like, in this fantasy where I'm like, okay, I see these books and the sort of desires that they're expressing as also products of a culture in which like the second wave happened, third wave happened. You know, they're not like these kind of like pre-modern gender politics books.
Yeah.
And then like something that happens is that a lot of the times in the action and what Abby calls the hijinks and the wars that ensue, something about that young woman's unique gifts and her unique sexual allure are drawn upon for these like world-saving tasks of high stakes, right? And the other thing is there's like a lot of sex scenes, which are like explicit and prolonged and often do involve like non-human partners or partners with not just magical capacities, but often like different bodies. And one of the things I did for this podcast was I reread Andrea Dworkin's Theory of Fairy Tales from her 1973, I think, book Woman Hating, her first book, where she talks about fairy tales as told to children as parables of female passivity and symbolic necrophilia. She deals with sort of like the Disney version of things like Snow White or Sleeping Beauty, in which there is a woman who is so passive and so beautiful that she's kind of dead, right?
Yeah.
She depicts them as stories that are talking about female agency is always being punished, right? The mm-hmm. only women who ever do anything in these fairy tales, from like the Grimm version to the Disney version, are the wicked stepmothers who wind up being sort of like punished for acting in the world. And then the heroines are only ever acted on to the fact that they're like literally unconscious. In the case of like at least Snow White and Sleeping Beauty, these kind of like two paradigmatic examples. The romantasy heroines and the romantasy heroes by extension, they sort of like alternately affirm and contradict this model. on a superficial level, I think the romantasy heroine is like very active and agential, right? She's yes. often spunky.
Yep.
She can be a little like acerbic, at least in ACOTAR. There's like a lot of witty banter in which she's kind of like teasing or undermining or talking back to these like authority figures. They start kind of tomboyish. Throughout the course of the book, they're often like converted or initiated into femininity through these kind of trials that reveal their like true natures or true destinies, right? But they do like make choices. They're not like literally inert, like Snow White in the glass coffin.
Yeah, and an interesting point there too. We start with A Court of Thorns and Roses. Fair, who's the protagonist, has essentially two wicked stepsisters who happen to be her actual sisters. She's like out there like gutting venison and like they're like, oh, I want to buy a nice dress and whatever. Like, so the wickedness is basically just straight up this kind of fairy tale femininity. And she's like showing up blood spatter being like, why the fuck do I have to do everything around here? You're right. Like they're clearly sort of in the first 20, 30 pages of that book, there's already a kind of playing with Grimm's tropes. And there is already a kind of a model of femininity that the main character sort of wants to distinguish herself from.
Right. Like the trivial aspects of femininity or the superficial, the cosmetic aspects of femininity, they're depicted as like women have to earn this through a kind of noble suffering or like demonstration of virtue in order to achieve sort of like the pretty dress beauty stuff. And the women who do that or access that or try to claim that without suffering are sort of like cheating the system and are therefore unworthy. That's like one sort of recurring concept of what being girly means. But then like there's also ways in which these characters are kind of passive on the larger scale, like their broader circumstances, whether that be like you have magic powers or you're going to be in the fairy world like an ACOTAR or like you are going to become this like dragon warrior. Like those are decisions that are made for them by other people.
Or by fate. I mean, that's sort of the strangeness that is like you get this sense of like, spunky is the right word, which is one of those words that we use to describe women, and it's
patronizing.
It's supposed to be a compliment, but it's actually kind of patronizing, infantilizing. Yeah, like I would be mad if somebody referred to me as spunky, but it is the right word for these heroines who are quite young also.
Well, spunkiness to me also implies like pushing back while also accommodating yourself, right? Like it's not full autonomy. It's sort of like bucking while also going along. And that, like, I think that describes what they do quite well.
It's a kind of lower stakes agency or like constrained agency.
Lower order, exactly, yeah.
That adorably rebels against but cannot actually refute or undo the childlike or lower status, right? And I think, mm-hmm. Abby, your point about fate, the role of fate or destiny or like sort of like some kind of predestination that's like often kind of supernatural. It might be like inherited, this is your family destiny, or it might be like a prophecy or like some sort of like choosing of these women. On the one hand, it makes them like not like other girls, right?
Right.
It's not about women's class solidarity like at all.
No.
These women often like don't really have other women friends. Like, do these pass the Bechdel test? I'm actually not always sure. But then there's also a way in which they're sort of like removed from responsibility, right? The fatedness means that they have agency, they make choices, but they're not like culpable exactly.
Right. Well, and this is where we also, because of like above all, like the trope of the fated mate, it almost reminds me of like, you know, we don't live in a time where premarital sex is really frowned upon anymore, but the sort of idea of like, well, if you get married, then you're allowed to have sex, right? So you might do it really young. You're allowed to have sexual desire if he's your fated mate. Like that's part of like the fantasy space that these books are opening up.
Interesting.
You know, you start as this like maybe kind of spunky, like, I don't know, 17, 18, 19-year-old, but with your 500-year-old fated mate, you will be experiencing like a whole new world of like pleasure and desire and sexuality. And in some ways, I think like a kind of agency that is nothing to sneer at in mainstream fiction.
Can I comp lit out for a second here?
Oh my God, please. Adrian, compare some literatures. Just do it.
So I want to point something out. you know, literary scholars look at literature in ways that their normal readers don't. So let me point something out that may have escaped some of our listeners. These books are long, y'all. They're super fucking long. But there's something interesting with that. Like, when I was texting Moira that, like, I really felt like there was some real paid-by-the-word energy to Court of Thorns and Roses, in the sense that, like, on a sentence-by-sentence level, it's, I think, very well written. But there's a lot of reduplication, a lot of extraneous detail, a lot of, like, one little observation makes the point, and then a second observation makes the point. And then, just in case you didn't get it, there's a third one. I don't love that style, but I think actually it works for this in a weird way for one reason, right? There's this detail and repetition, which on the one hand, it also is how the book sort of scans its Regency era interiors. Like, once you leave the fantasy forest, you're suddenly in the 18th century and like everything's fucking like designy. And like, so like it spends a lot of time on like decanters, on like, you know, appointments, on couches, et cetera, right? Which is interesting. And the way Moira put it at the beginning was like, you kind of just submit to the flow. And I do think that like this idea of going with it and this idea of submitting to the sheer onslaught of these redundant details is in some way what these books do to their heroines too.
Oh, absolutely.
You do get to buck a little bit, you get to mock it a little bit, but in the end, your experience of reading these books is submission. You are sort of like, okay, fine, I guess I'm fated to read this book right now for my podcast and I'll just let it all wash over me. It's a book that encourages you to kind of mock it in the micro, but then kind of submit to it in the macro.
Yeah.
And that is exactly its gender politics, I feel like.
Oh, yeah. But let's also get into the age gaps.
Let's do it.
Because all of these are teenage girls or very young women with supernatural creatures that are living on a longer timeline, right? And there's something about the unreality and the removal from what we might take as like a recognizable social context that I think provides permission for the age gap, but they're also sort of like played with and eroticized on their like own terms or on more familiar terms. Abby, I wanted to hear your thoughts about these.
Before I give you my thoughts, I absolutely must read you a pull quote from a recent Times article about this very precise phenomenon, the age gap in romantasy literature. Quote, "But what's the appeal of a 500-year-old boyfriend?" Exactly. "Maybe real life." Quote, "It's about the idea of someone who'd be mature and experienced enough to share the mental load with you," said Elizabeth Wheatley, 29, a romance author and romantasy fan who lives in Austin. She said that many women who read these books are in their late 20s to their 40s with jobs and families to juggle and sometimes lack support from a male partner to such an extent that it feels as if they're, quote, "raising children and their partners as well." "I suspect the appeal of someone who's 100 or 600 years older is someone who wouldn't have to be taught how to apply for health insurance or fill out a car registration," Ms. Wheatley said.
"Maybe at 500, the man-child I have at home will finally be old enough to fucking, you know, buy milk by himself." Yeah, that checks out.
I mean, this strikes me as like kind of a piece with Adrian, your note about the sort of genre similarities to young adult fiction, right? Like, one of the critiques that you hear from people who are like kind of skeptical of romantasy is that it's about a sort of fundamentally dishonorable desire by women to return to childhood, right? That's like, I think, a critique I would make of this book. It's a critique I've made of Tradwives, right?
Yeah.
It's this notion that like you're removed from responsibility and you're placed into a world of wish fulfillment. But the other way to look at it is like, what would it take for men to abandon childhood and
yeah,
for men to like join women in a level of adult responsibility in a cultural moment when like responsibility, delayed gratification, competence all have been feminized,
yeah, mm-hmm,
and sort of like petulance and like instant gratification are the realm of masculinity and basically,
yeah,
all that seems to be left of it. That kind of gendered asymmetry of adulthood and childishness and the sort of perceived masculine claim on the prerogatives of childhood, even into adult life, I think like does really tax women a lot and makes them like pretty tired. And so like part of the fantasy is like, yeah, how much older than me would he have to be before he started acting like an adult?
Yeah.
And that's a hilarious answer that it's 500 years old.
Yeah, yeah. That's great. I mean, like, it's the answer. Like, when does man keeping stop? In your 500s? Yeah.
I mean, it would make more sense if you were like, oh, so he's 500 and, you know, he's just been really investing well and just the power of compound interest, you know. But it's not even that. It's a very strange thing. Like when you flip the genders and you think about the idea of like a 17-year-old boy and a 500-year-old woman, it's not thinkable within the pages of this kind of book. It becomes predatory. It becomes verging on like evil queen territory straight out of Dworkin's writing about fairy tales, is like the malignant aspects of the feminine, like the phallic mother, the castrating woman. Like, I mean, not to go all vulgar Freudianism, but sometimes that'll get you 90% of the way there.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
The only time it's really been done is in Harold and Maude, where she is like just straight up a 9-year-old manic pixie dream girl. You know, she's like that's the only way they pull it off is to have her be so aggressively playful and kind of childlike.
Yeah. I had to think of like SNL did a skit a couple of years ago when that Japanese show Old Enough, where like the 4-year-olds go to the grocery store and they did Old Enough Live-In Boyfriend Edition, where they made their boyfriends go to Sephora and they're completely lost. And so like maybe when they're 500, they're like, yeah, I can shop for blush for you. That's fine.
I mean,
probably
I'm
not.
44 and I find it hard to navigate I've Sephora.
Men, we're asking too much of you.
This also might bring us to like one of the other themes you noted, Abby, which is like the recurring theme of the shadow daddy. Do you want to tell us about the shadow daddy?
Yeah. So I have to say, one, I don't know where this term comes from, but two, I did not actually put in any effort to try to track it down because it's just everywhere. And the two texts that we've picked as our specimen series both have a shadow daddy, and it seems to mean something like, this is a man who, in addition to being like extremely hot and extremely into you, you person identifying with the female protagonist, has powers and specifically powers of darkness. And lest you think that that's a metaphor, it's not a metaphor. Huh. I mean, it's like Zayden from Fourth Wing can make shadows fall over the land. And also his shadows can kind of like, I don't know, maybe they could pick you up and he could use them during sex. Like shadows are like an all-purpose kind of thing. But they also maybe index that he's a, to use another like romance trope, like he's a morally gray character, right? Mm-hmm. Like he's an upright man, but he would burn the whole world down if you were in trouble. So it is actually like having control over darkness.
This also like strikes me as a recurring part of one of the fundamental themes of the romanticy genre, which we already talked about a little bit, which is the enemies to lovers trope. And it seems like central in these books that the cantankerous male character, the guy who starts off as like kind of antagonistic, as being rivalrous with the main female character, or even as like actively hating her, that this is somebody who is like actually just displaying a defense mechanism that conceals the intensity of his desire or is his loyalty to the heroine, right? It's like this notion where actually hatred is just a stop along the way to a different sort of relation. It's like a con or a denial of love, right? And once that kind of love is avowed, it becomes just like remarkably strong and enduring. It's like unable to be permanently denied or resisted, but it is able to propel this male character to all kinds of heights of like, you know, courage or effort.
Which also makes these books kind of an interesting response to an age in which, I mean, it's not like we have more online misogyny than we did before, but what we have is a kind of more unvarnished form of misogyny, sort of shaping the life worlds of especially younger men. Just stuff that like people would not say into a front-facing camera until recently. They now very much do, and I do wonder if there's like that people have to kind of assign to hatred and to antagonism a different status just because there's so much of it. Could that be some of what's at work here?
Well, this strikes me as perhaps related to something that Abby was talking to us about when we were discussing this episode before we started recording, which is one of the things these books do is act as a kind of like psychological self-help or like vehicle for emotional repair for a readership that is like confronting, as you say, Adrian, a ton of misogyny online and in public discourse, but which has also probably confronted a ton of violence in their own lives, right? Yeah. Like, we're dealing with kind of, you know, when we talk about women readers, or when we talk about, like, women, this, like, vast umbrella underneath, like, a ton of people live, what we're talking about is, like, a constituency of mass trauma.
Yeah.
I almost cringe from using the word trauma now because of all the different ways that it gets diminished or the ways that it gets hijacked for what strike me as nefarious ends. But what you're dealing with is like a huge proportion of people living under this category of women who have been raped, right? Or a huge proportion of people living under this category of women who have experienced domestic violence or intimate partner violence, or a huge proportion of people, like basically all of the people living under this category, even if they have not directly firsthand experienced such violence, they are living under its threat. And its threat is shaping their intimate and erotic lives, right?
Yes.
So one of the things that, like, Abby, I thought this was kind of genius, was that you had this theory of romanticy as sort of like fulfilling or charting in its plots some of what, like, psychiatrists talk about as, like, the necessary preconditions for, like, the healing of a traumatized patient.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm actually really glad that we're getting to talk about this, Moira, because I know that the figure who I asked you to read or reread, Judith Herman, is somebody whose work you really admire, and I also really admire. And in order to get into, I'm not going to quite call it a grand unified theory of romanticy, but let's say rather something like, what is the therapeutic function of this body of work? So my take is, essentially, and this came from reading the fifth book. Yes, I made it all the way through. The fifth book in the ACOTAR universe, which is no longer about Farah, but about her sister, Nesta.
Oh, she comes back. Yeah,
she comes back. And it was reading this book where I really started to think the primary function of romanticy is as self-help masquerading as fiction. Mm. That it is a way, and I think a really effective way, to help a lot of readers, primarily but not all women readers, work through their own trauma, which may or may not be sexual trauma. So I'll give you a very, very quick and dirty version of, what is this book called? A Court of Silver Flames.
Mm.
So we get to the sister who's traumatized by all of the previous events in the ACOTAR universe, which I am not going to recount, and also she gets turned into a fairy against her own will, and she's in a dark, dark place. She is drinking a lot and having anonymous sex with various fairy men. Oh, and Moira, this is a point that I meant to bring up before that I feel like you will really want as a data point, is that in the ACOTAR universe and in some other romanticy books, the words aren't men and women, but males and females.
Oh my God. Oh.
Which is not, I think, just because they're not always women in the sense of human women. It has that kind of like ickiness to when people in regular life, in colloquial American English, say females and males, and you're just like, oh, your sexual politics are going to be really suspect. So that's there, and that's something that's picked up by other fantasy authors. So she's drinking a lot, and she's having sex with a lot of fairy males. She's not enjoying it, right? She's in a dark place.
Yeah, it's sex as self-harm, right?
It is, yes, it is sex as self-harm. And the book, which is really long, basically, she spends hundreds and hundreds of pages learning to come back to life. Like, she has to give up drinking, get really into exercise, at which point I was like, yeah, like, girl, relatable. but, like, unlike me, like, getting really into yoga or Pilates or whatever, like, she is training to become a Valkyrie warrior, okay? And along the way, there is agency and empowerment. And of course, she has a fated mate too. He's the general of the Night Court. So there's this man who's going to support you as you become yourself. And also, he's going to give you countless orgasms because the men in these books are nothing if not sexually generous.
Unlike the men on the original Night Court, who was kind of such.
Adrian Dog.
I'm sorry. The joke was right there.
Of all the things that could have happened today, that was not on my list, but it gave me a lot of joy. Okay, So thinking about this, I was like, I actually had to go pull out my copy of Judith Herman's Trauma and Recovery, which is a book that is roughly the size of any of the ACOTAR books, but it is a very different kind of read. It is structured around the two poles of trauma and recovery, and it is written in two sections. The first half is about traumatic disorders, and the second half is about the stages of recovery. And I really think that, you know, as sort of crystallized in this one particular ACOTAR book, but I think this is something that we can expand to account for the way that so many people, again, primarily, but not entirely women, like immerse themselves and roll around in romanticy series after romanticy series. It looks so much like the stages of recovery. So what does recovery require? Recovery from trauma. That's what I'm meaning specifically here, which could be a number of forms of trauma. But as Moira alluded to earlier, sexual trauma is never not in the background. So it's about what Herman calls empowerment of the survivor. So she has to have autonomy. She has to have agency. She has to have control. Doesn't mean that she doesn't need help. Right? She does, but no one can do it for her. Because so much of trauma, as Herman conceives of it, is being made to be helpless and also being made to be alone. And one of the things that you'll notice, I mean, you both read the first ACOTAR book, right? Is it's kind of abusive. It's abusive in the way that, like, Wuthering Heights is abusive also. Like, you know, this isn't new. And it's abusive in the way that Buffy the Vampire Slayer is abusive to Buffy. Which is not just to say that it's a trauma plot, but that it's about the accumulation of trauma. Right? Just the second you think that this, like, spunky little girl is going to get up, you know, somebody smacks her right back down again.
She's going to get smacked around. That is the plot.
The plot is that the protagonist is being abused. And I just don't, I don't think that that gets talked about enough because it's all like fairy sex and weird fated mates. But none of these books work if you don't have to go through several hundred pages of the protagonist being abused, like in ways where bones break over and over. And she comes back from it and she's psychically abused and she's physically abused. And it makes you think very much about the category that Judith Herman talks about as compound PTSD, right? Like, these are not situations that you survive as the same person.
Yeah, I mean, we meet the protagonist, Fair, in ACOTAR at a moment when she's a half-orphan. Her father is essentially absented himself. He's just kind of sitting there with his own mental health issues. She is essentially, you know, being set upon by her two evil stepsisters, who are her actual sisters, whatever. And which I think is actually pretty unusual in a fantasy novel, but you can correct me on this, just physically hungry. This is a person who's lost lots of weight from, and it looks haggard.
She's gaunt.
Mistaken for a boy because she's gaunt.
Starving.
She's
starving.
She's
actually starving.
And I think you're right. Like, she starts the story and you're like, holy shit, like, I mean, the person I sort of flashed back to was like Arya Stark, but like Arya Stark gets there over several books and bit by bit by bit. And like, even she doesn't quite accumulate what Fair sort of carrying on page one of this book. It's really quite astonishing.
Right. And it keeps going like that. I mean, it just keeps going for page after page after page. And interestingly, because these are contemporary books, I mean, I'm not like a betting person, but I would bet a sizable amount of money that these authors have read The Body Keeps the Score. Right? Like, the language of trauma is actually there. It's being mobilized. Like, you don't have to reach for it. It is actually in these pages. So, okay, the first part of a romanticy, we get the repeated traumatization of the female protagonist in all sorts of creative ways, both physical and psychic. And then we get, in the romantic relationship, we get what Herman calls the healing relationship. Except, of course, because if she's a psychiatrist, she's talking about the therapist and she's talking about the therapeutic alliance. And so, you know, Moira, you were posing the question earlier, I honestly don't remember whether it was off or on mic at this point, about like, why do men, like regular non-fairy or non-angel or non, I don't know.
Dragons, non-dragon. Vampires.
Yeah, I don't think they're having sex with the dragons mostly, but yeah.
That feels like an oversight.
Why can't we even have fantasies now about regular men? I think this is part of the appeal. We need someone who is literally superhuman in order to be able to handle what has been done to us, like us as, you know, the reader identifying with the protagonist. And interestingly enough, in ACOTAR and in the Fourth Wing books, the Shadow Daddy figure is also himself traumatized.
Mm.
And in particular, in ACOTAR, he's a survivor of literally 50 years of consecutive rape.
Yeah.
So there's like a mutual, we're healing each other together thing going on. But so what happens in the like recovery parts here is like she regains control. She gets strong. She gets powers. Maybe she gets a dragon. Maybe she gets two dragons. She definitely works out a lot. This is a very important feature. They're always training to battle to the death. And so they become these dangerous women to be feared, but without sacrificing or renouncing femininity, right? Like, as Adrian was pointing out about the 18th century element of all this, it's like they move like seamlessly from like battle to like the bedroom to like, I don't know, maybe the boardroom, if that's something that's happening. And this is really related to Herman talking about becoming safe in one's body. Again, you know, these are women who are rediscovering their bodies as strong and as instruments to protect themselves. I pulled a quote from Herman here that I thought was helpful in thinking about this. And of course, again, Herman is talking from the position of the therapist. But she says, quote, "The traumatized person is often relieved simply to learn the true name of her condition. By ascertaining her diagnosis, she begins the process of mastery. No longer imprisoned in the wordlessness of the trauma, she discovers that there is a language for her experience. She discovers that she is not alone. Others have suffered in similar ways. She discovers further that she is not crazy. The traumatic syndromes are normal human responses to extreme circumstances. And she discovers, finally, that she is not doomed to suffer this condition indefinitely. She can expect to recover as others have recovered." Close quote. So, you know, we can talk more about this because I think there's a lot of room for where fantasy takes you. But this is the fundamental fantasy of these books, is that you can recover.
Yeah.
You can get better. You can protect yourself. And that, I think, is like not nothing. Again, when we put this next to Bella Swan.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
I love this as a place to stop, right? Because I think there's like one impulse, and this was my initial impulse when I first started encountering these texts, right? I was like, oh God, this is gross, right? Like, this is a fantasy of, dare I say it, this might be a little bit of a like a patronizing word to use about like literal like fairies and dragons, et cetera. But this is like kind of like straight, boring, like dominance-based heterosexual sex, right? Like this is something I recognize from every script, and I find it sort of politically suspect and also just sort of like repetitive and not conducive in most of its uses towards like the feminism that I want to see in the world, right? And then I think I started thinking about it differently after, Abby, you introduced this concept. It's like, yeah, these are people who are inhabiting their own embodiment in ways that are different from the use and the victimization, right? These are people who are passing through trials into a kind of like vindication, and that vindication is often happening at the site of their previous victimization, right?
Yes, exactly.
Which is like the body, and specifically like the sex and romantic and intimate body. And I think it's a much more optimistic reading that makes me feel a lot better about all the women on TikTok who are sharing this with each other. It hints at something like truly utopian that is being reached for in these books.
See, listeners, Embed with the Ride can talk itself into hetero-optimism.
I would not want to be accused of hetero-optimism. I'm sorry.
No, we keep getting the opposite, that people are like, are you just telling us all to be gay? It's like, well, yeah, pretty much. But
I mean, I guess I want to say one thing Moira, which is that fantasy, and I mean that not just in the like the genre of fantasy, but like fantasy, this thing that we all do.
Yeah.
Fantasy is adult play space. Children have play and they need to play, right? It's where they work things out. Adults have fantasy and we need those kinds of things. And if I were simply thinking about the kind of work that these books could do for readers' fantasy lives in terms of like their sexual politics, I would be like, this isn't that interesting. But I think fantasy is more interesting than that. Sarah J. Maas and Rebecca Yarros are absolutely giving us what is like essentially like a pretty boring heteronormative romance in a lot of ways. And that doesn't strike me as groundbreaking or exciting, but millions and millions of people are resonating with them. And that makes me interested. And I do think that texts that seem to so reliably prompt or create the conditions for women to have this sort of like immersive play space that might also let them create and recreate themselves, I think that's good. I guess I'm on board with that. I think fantasy is a really capacious kind of like place to be and to play, and that we need more of that. I'm in favor of people having a rich interior life is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Bold. Bold claim, Kluchin. Abby, thank you so much for doing this with us. I feel like I got so much more out of these books with your guidance and your perspective than I would have otherwise. I just can't think of anybody I would have rather had on to talk to about it. So thank you so much for joining us.
It's such a pleasure. I'm such a huge fan of In Bed With a Right and of both of you.
Oh, right back at you.
Everybody listen to Ordinary Unhappiness because it's great. All right. Thank you, folks. Thank you for listening.
In Bed With the Right is made possible by hundreds of listeners who support us via patreon.com. Our episodes are produced and edited by Mark Yoshizumi and Katie Lau. Our title music is by Katie Lau.